Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, do you feel rich? And what would it actually take to make you feel a bit richer? Move over Costa del Sol. It turns out Britain isn't such a bad place to retire. Also today, can you move and take your great low-rate mortgage with you? What's the point of EPCs? And Lee has been chatting with actor Ross Kemp. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, what makes you rich? It might have less to do with the wealth you've accumulated than you think. After all, it is, as Simon Lambert points out in his piece this week, notoriously difficult to spend your house, and you do need your pension to last through retirement. A common theme that runs through behavioural finance studies is our frequently mistaken belief that others get paid more than us. So how does your salary really stack up compared to your neighbours? Well, This Is Money has a new calculator. Simon Lee, welcome. Simon, why? Why have you got a new calculator? Tell me about it. What's the point, Simon?
Why not? There you go. Throw it back at you. Why not? Why not?
Good as answer as any.
Salary calculator that shows you where you fit in. Because everybody wants to know that, don't they? People love this stuff. They absolutely love this stuff. And also because we've got clever data and graphics bots who can build this kind of thing. And it's great. You put in your salary, your age, and you can put in your postcode, and you can choose your profession. And then it will tell you where you stand compared to the rest of the UK, how it compares to the average for your profession, and also how it compares to the average for your area. It will also tell you roughly what you're taking home each month and how much tax is eating up. And you can put in there if you've got a student loan, for example. People love to play around with calculators like this, and they love to look at this kind of stuff. Whenever we write a story about where do you fit, you know, amongst the UK's income levels or wealth levels or whatever, people absolutely love it. But quite often we have to say, get your salary, look at the chart, see which percentile you're in, and that's where you are. But if you can do it with a calculator, you can put it in and it can give you a great result, then that's brilliant. Also, I think what it illustrates to lots of people is that they're possibly doing better than they think. Now, there will be people who will unfortunately discover that they're not doing better than they think with this. But there is this sort of behavioral economics thing that goes on where everybody thinks other people are all earning more than us. And actually, quite often, it's a mistaken belief that that isn't the case. So let's choose a number out of the air, for example. If you are on £50,000, if you're knocking on the door of the higher rate tax threshold, then you earn more than 76% of people in the UK. Now, to be clear, the figures that we are using in this calculator are not just full-time earnings. It's all earnings. So it's full-time and part-time earnings. So what it does is you can actually put in exactly what you get and you can see where you fit compared to exactly what other people are getting. Now, I know that obviously most of us think in terms of salaries compared to full-time. So even if you don't work full-time, you compare it to your full-time equivalent. If you're self-employed, you're waiting for me to get to that, aren't you, Georgie?
So she also tinkering away on the calculator as well here. And I'm going, where's journalist? So carry on, Simon. I am paying attention.
If you're self-employed, then you can put in what your annual profits are each year. Okay. So if you're a sole trader, that's a simple number. If you have your own limited company, that's a slightly more complicated number. But, you know, most people, if they're self-employed, will know their number. They'll know what they earned last year. If you're retired as well, you can put in your pension income. Now, for a lot of people nowadays, your pension income will vary because it depends on how much you withdraw or how much you don't withdraw. Or you might be on a final salary scheme and you might get a regular pension income. But you can chuck in whatever number you want. And also, you can really chuck in whatever number you want. So you could chuck in 30, 50, 100, 200, £1 million.
Yeah.
See where that would put you, basically. It's a good fun tool to play around with, and it helps you understand a little bit more. And maybe it might help do you a favor, because you can go, okay, well, I'm earning less than the average for my job. I think I should be in the position where I do earn the average for my job. I mean, bear in mind, the average for your job includes all the people doing your job. So, and this is official ONS statistics. So it's all the people doing your job that the ONS has those statistics for. But that ranges from the person who's just started out in that profession to the person who's right at the top. So when I did my chuck a 50 grand number in here, I chose marketing, sales and advertising directors. So your pre-tax annual salary of £50,000 is around £39,520 after income tax, national insurance and student loan payments. I put that this person doesn't have the student loan. Okay. Now, the good news is for someone on £50,000 is they've not quite reached the point yet where the government starts taking a lot more of their money as they get dragged into the 40% tax threshold. This boils down to around £3,293 per month. Compared to all other employees in the UK, you earn more than 76%. Your pre-tax salary of £50,000 is less, 40% less than the average of £82,962 for marketing, sales and advertising directors. Bear in mind, this isn't just people working in marketing, sales and advertising. It's directors. So it's like people at the top. It then compares it to, you know, what you'd get. You can compare it to what you get if you're a nurse, a doctor and so on. And your £50,000 salary means that you earn more than 57% of earners in the local authority district that I live in, which is St. Albans. Now, there'd probably be loads of people who think, well, I'm 50 grand in that area. I'm going to
get
less than most people. But actually, it'll tell you that you're doing better. You're doing 18% more. And then you can drill down across the country. So,
and finally, this is really interesting because it sort of goes to the heart, as I sort of suggested at the start, and Simon did in his article, that what makes us feel rich isn't necessarily how much we've got in our bank accounts or how big our house is. It's how big our neighbour's house is, how much they've got in their bank account. It's so human, isn't it? But actually, it does make a difference where you are in the UK, the type of job that you do, obviously. Why are things like this useful, do you think, Lee? What else are these calculators telling us? What other data have you got from me?
And of course, if your neighbour's got a flashy BMW on the drive, they must be doing really, really well.
Or obviously.
Or they've put it on finance. the jury's out. Unfortunately, you don't have a calculator for that.
You could probably just go, how much would it cost to PCP that car? Okay, they're £600 poorer than I am every month.
Well, there is that. These calculators, I think all financial calculators on the whole are helpful, Georgie. I think every week that goes by, I definitely will use a calculator, whether it's a compound calculator, whether it's a savings interest calculator, whether it's looking at how my pension's performing and where I might be going in the future with it. I think all of these kind of tools that we have at our disposal are really, really helpful. And our tool can be found at thisismoney.co.uk/howrich. So you can go and check this out for yourself. I like this, first of all, because you can go, I think that the comparisons that it gives you here, these four different ways it breaks it down. Number one is how much more or less than you earn compared to the whole of Britain. I'm not going to tell you what my figure is. I've plugged in my details and it makes for interesting reading, and it might give you a big ego boost. It might make you go, oh, actually, do you know what? I kind of don't feel that rich, but I'm earning X percent more than the rest of the country, for one.
Yeah.
Then there's the job data, and you can compare how that goes with other people within your sector. And you can even click on other professions such as nurses, doctors, teachers, police officers, chief execs, shop workers, lawyers, and bin men and women, and you can see how you compare to all of those different professions, which I think is really interesting. Then it goes to the kind of local and regional breakdown. So I'm in the Rochford district, so it shows me how it puts me compared to other people in the Rochford area, but then also in the east of England, which I think is really interesting. And then it has this lovely map at the end, and it tells you how much more or less you're earning than your average neighbour in the area and what the median salary is in the area. They're all very nifty tools. And actually, if you feel like, if you plug this in, and this is where I think the calculator is probably the most useful, is if you plug this in and then actually realise that other people in your profession are potentially earning more than you, or, you know, you might end up feeling a little bit hard done by, and you might go off and start investigating potentially whether or not it's time for a pay increase. You know, when was the last time you had a pay increase? You know, perhaps you get a annual increase that's linked to inflation, but perhaps you don't. You know, perhaps your workplace has paused that. Have you been in a job for a long time and you're being a bit taken advantage of because, you know, you haven't moved around or you haven't requested pay increases? So I think it's interesting to compare to your neighbours, but I think it's more interesting to compare with your profession and whether or not you are doing well. And in this story, we have the 20 highest paid jobs and the 20 lowest paid jobs. And we've carried this data on the website for a very long time. And actually, Richard Browning, bless him, was one of the kind of key components of updating this every year. And it was always a massive traffic driver. A lot of people were interested in reading this. And number one on the list, what do you think is?
CEO, company director, barrister.
That's what exactly what I thought. I thought lawyer, barrister, chief.
Yeah.
Actually, number one, aircraft pilots and air traffic controllers, £96,415. Now, I'm guessing the reason why this is kind of at the top is because it's quite a narrow pool of people. It's a very skilled profession. I'm not saying that being a chief exec and being a lawyer isn't, but there's probably a more broader kind of data set to go on.
Yeah, a bit more of a spectrum, isn't it? Because you can have junior doctors all the way up to consultants, for example. Yeah, so I suppose the salary band would be smaller. Is that what we're saying?
I think so, yeah. And you look through, you know, some of these jobs, public relations and communications directors get into number six on this list of paid jobs. And then there's things like senior police officers, kind of halfway down this list, 63,000. Train and tram drivers just behind, obviously very topical this week, £63,853. But I think it's again, to use that data wisely, could be either A, retraining and doing a different profession if you feel like you are being gravely underpaid and you potentially do have the academic skill to take something else on. You know, I think that that's not a bad place to be. The other way is to sort of say to your children or grandchildren, look, if you follow this career path, you're going to be getting paid much more than following this career path. And I think, you know, having all of this data to hand, it's always a good thing. I think knowledge is always power, Georgian, and having it in your hands and being able to look at all this is an interesting data set.
Knowledge is power indeed. I wouldn't recommend, though, recommending certain jobs to your children. I'm not sure how many jobs on that list will still be there. But it is interesting. I saw you smirk there, Lee, about public relations, because as journalists, we do know that a lot of our compatriots, brethren, whatever, do end up in PR. And you're looking at the statistics here, I cannot see journalism in the highest paid jobs. But anyway, Simon, if anybody does want to ask for a pay rise, give us a little tip how to bag a wage increase. You've even got a section here on the website.
Ask for it.
Well, I mean, that is a start, right? I mean, if you don't ask, you'll be never get. Well, I mean, actually, you might do. The best pay raise I ever got was really early on in my career. It was actually at BBC London Sport. And he said, I'm going to give you a £5 pay rise. And it was the best pay rise I've ever had because it was just so out of the blue.
There's holes in this. Is this £5 a second, a minute, a day, a week?
Oh, a day rate. Day rate. I'll do it. Yeah. And I appreciate £5 is not a vast amount. But, you know, I was young and it was the gesture. I didn't ask for it. He just said, I've pushed it up to as high as it can go. And I thought, I'll take that £5 with grit. And I still talk about it now, 800 years later. Simon, how to bag that pay rise?
Well, firstly, ask for it. Lee's right. Secondly, read the room. What's going on in your business, in your organisation, in your team? Pick your moment. Is it a good moment to be asking for more money? Is there an annual pay review around about which time it would be a good time to have the conversation? Or do you feel that you need to have the conversation halfway through the year? But again, as I said, you know, read the room. So if things aren't going great, then, you know, it's probably not going to be the best time to ask for a pay rise. And also, you might potentially be blowing your opportunity because it's difficult to be doing this constantly. Now, there are some industries where people are doing this constantly. There are people who do this constantly and they do very, very well. And men tend to get better pay rises than women because traditionally men ask for it more so than women and are less apologetic about asking for pay rises. So don't be apologetic about asking for it. But the key thing, I think, is to demonstrate your value to your employer. Why are you worth that pay rise? Why do they want to pay you more in order to keep you there and reward you for what you're doing? So, you know, we've got some tips here from an employment expert who said, highlight how you've gone over, above and beyond your role by contributing to, you know, driving revenue, completing key projects, delivering new things, cost savings, stepping up with new responsibilities, any new skills or qualifications you've gained, consistent positive feedback from clients or colleagues. Look at what other people in similar roles are earning. You can find that stuff out. It's not the greatest time at the moment to be asking for it. The jobs market is super tight. It's turned from being a very good jobs market to a very bad jobs market. But also, I think one thing I would say is don't just expect a big pay rise just for doing your job. It never ceases to amaze me the number of people for whom they're like, well, I want progression. And it's like, well, what does progression mean for you? And like, well, more money, obviously, or a job title. And you're like, well, no, progression also means learning and developing. And it, quite often people will come in and they'll do a job and they'll be like, right, I've been doing it for a year now. I want a big pay rise. It's like, well, actually, you've kind of only just really learned to do your job at this organization. From the other side, quite often, really 6 months, a year, people have just got themselves bedded in. And, you know, you should expect an annual pay review, an annual pay rise, at least to try and keep up with inflation, right? But to go over and above, to get what people are really talking about here, it's about demonstrating that value and demonstrating why you're ready to step up to the next level, rather than just being like, well, I'm doing my job and I'm doing it well. Because actually that's the baseline, right? Doing your job and doing it well is just what your boss expects.
Simon, can I have a £5 a day pay rise, please? I've just been listening and taking on board what you're saying. And like, you seem to be
pencil in his hand, guys.
I do make a mean cup of tea. I think I did make one a couple of years ago for you. And I just think I'm an all-round good guy and I'd quite like a pay rise.
Tea and good guy, I'd put that in the basic box, you know, to be honest. You should do it. What I would say, though, and just to pick one point there, Simon, there is evidence to suggest that women do ask as much as men. We just don't get it as much. Now, someone asked me online, because people like to ask me stuff online, in perhaps a less polite way than I'm going to suggest is now, is it down to sexism? That's a very simplistic way of looking at it. I don't think it's down to sexism necessarily. It could very well be the way that perhaps, like you said, more apologetically asking for it. So it might be the style in which you're asking. We might not expect to get it because we don't think other people ask for it. Perhaps we're a bit more, like you say, I'm really sorry, maybe I don't deserve it. So actually, things like this are really useful to read the kind of tips and advice that is certainly on your website, to have a bit more ammunition to go in and a bit less apologetic, like Simon just said there. Lee, you were going to talk, sorry?
I was just going to say, like, as someone that's been on both sides of the fence, as someone that's asked for a pay rise and also and someone that's been asked for pay rises, I mean, it obviously it depends on what profession you're in and what industry you're in and how high pressured it is and all of that kind of thing. But I think if you have a good boss and a boss that kind of understands that basically men and women are equal, and you know, certainly that's the viewpoint I take. And I would say that I've had both female journalists and male journalists ask for pay rises and different titles and things over the years, and it's completely on merit. You know, it's just, I don't even think about sex or, you know, anything like that. It's just whether you've done a good job and, as Simon said, gone above and beyond, want to keep you and deserving of it. I think that's the way and the attitude that bosses should have. And if your boss doesn't have that attitude, then, you know, it might be time to be looking elsewhere and getting your true value, your true worth.
I think that rightly or wrongly, what goes on and a lot of the time, and actually I'd probably argue this is wrongly, just to be clear. So rightly or wrongly was absolutely the wrong thing to start that sentence with. Is that because we don't really have much salary transparency in this country, people don't know what their peers are earning, okay? Like, maybe it would just be better if everybody's salary was public and then they would know. There are some organisations where that is the case, you know, for example, organisations that have to declare salaries above a certain level. It'd be really interesting to read some research as to, you know, whether people get a better deal. But certainly I suspect that salaries not being transparent only helps, you know, the big employers. It doesn't help the workers, you know, of the world kind of thing. But I think that one of the things that goes on is it's this, how likely is this person to walk, right? And how much does it matter to me if they walk? So those are two things that combine. How much do I need to keep this person happy, and how big an impact is it going to have if they go? In some jobs, that's easy to measure because people, salespeople, people who drive revenue and that kind of thing. In other jobs, it's much, much harder to measure, but people will have a vague idea of people's importance to the team, to the organization, and so on. And I think one of the things that goes on between the genders is that actually when you look at pay gaps and stuff like that, the pay gap isn't really there until women reach the age of like having kids, right? Basically, and not all women have kids. Lots of women don't have kids, right? And it then becomes this scenario where I think that most of the responsibilities, parental responsibilities and care responsibilities, still do fall on women. You know, it's not equally spread out. It's not, you know, as a man in the workplace, you wouldn't feel as comfortable even asking for some of that stuff in many cases. Okay. Men will feel that they will have stuff loaded against them if they ask to take on those parental responsibilities. Whereas women feel that they're expected to do it, so they don't have it loaded against them. But the flip side of that is that I think, you know, there will be cases where people go, well, you know, firstly, the women don't want to rock the boat if they're in a good position, good employer, treats them well, gives them the flexibility that they need and so on. And always remember that about your job is it's not just the money, it's the satisfaction. It's the people you work with. It's the, why do I get up in the morning and go to work? What feeling do I get from coming back from work? We could all probably do jobs that pay us more money, right? But maybe you wouldn't enjoy them as much and maybe your life would be more miserable. So I think it comes down to like some of that stuff, like how much is this worth to me? Do I want to rock the boat? But on the flip side, I think maybe from manager's point of view and employer's point of view, wrongly, as I said, not rightly or wrongly, it comes down to, well, you know, they're probably not going to walk because it's going to cause them more of a headache. They're not going to find as good a environment as this. And so maybe like that's why once you start to get to the age when people are raising families and stuff, you know, men start to get the better pay rises and you start to get that pay gap developing because they feel that they are in a better position to rock the boat and that they can walk if they need to. And maybe the employer goes, well, actually they might walk, they're more likely to walk. I don't know, but I think that's potentially one thing that goes on.
All right then, moving on. We Brits do love to retire to a place in the sun. But is the Costa del Sol or the Algarve really preferable to the UK to spend your latter years? Britain actually ranks pretty highly as a place to spend retirement, according to a new study. So Lee, why would we go anywhere else? What is this study? What does it tell us? What would your preference be?
Oh, Britain's beautiful, isn't it, Georgie? What a place to spend your latter years with your pension. You know, we always see these stories illustrated in the newspapers and online with a retired couple on a yacht with a glass of champagne with a sunset, when in reality, you know, you could be at home with a cup of tea watching Mrs. Marple or whatever you want to do on TV and having a jolly good time in retirement. So this was a survey by asset manager Natixis, the Global Retirement Index. So it compiles it every year. And there's kind of two elements to it. So the first element is it looks at it. It ranks countries across the world of all populations, etc. So it analyzes 44 of the largest and most advanced countries. And Britain comes 14th on this list. But when you strip out the less populous but wealthy European countries, so in that top five is Norway, Switzerland, Ireland, Iceland, and Denmark. Once you strip out the kind of less populous areas and the economies that are kind of not as global and not as large, Britain actually comes now second only to Germany. It has overtaken Canada in this list. Now, what it looks at, and you might be thinking, well, how has it sort of figured this out? So it looks at the financial indicators, so i.e., you know, your state pension, your private pension, cost of living, all of that kind of thing. It looks at health and especially life expectancy, which actually the UK jumped up from 18th to 10th on this list, which was the big thing that kind of done this. But the financial markers, which is equality and unemployment, slipped compared with last year. Why unemployment's in that, though, I'm not too sure, because this is the retirement index. I wasn't entirely sure what they meant by that. But the health, quality of life, material well-being and finances, and 11th for quality of life for the third year of the row. The thing that we ranked the most poorly on is happiness. The UK fell from 18th to 21st place, but that was in line with European peers, France and Germany. So, you know, there's pressures on retirement across the world, and the rankings for the UK do remain consistent, but, you know, there are obviously vulnerabilities. And what kind of retirement you have, as we've discussed many, many times, is hugely variable, definitely from a kind of regional perspective. And from an age perspective as well, you know, we're coming out of an era now where lots of people have had gold-plated pensions, and we are heading into an era where most people have had to DIY their pensions, you know, as in invest themselves, put their own contributions in, employers' contributions, and kind of make sure that the onus is on them to make sure that the sum of money you're going to have in retirement is going to be ample enough. And it is a real mixed picture when you really drill down across the country as to the people, you know, we've talked about this before, the comfortable retirement, the kind of basic retirement. Lots of people will not meet that basic retirement level. But what's quite interesting about this, though, I think, out of the large developed countries, if I give you the rundown of the list, so Germany's first, Britain's second, Canada's third, then the US, Korea, Japan, France, Poland, Italy, Spain. I think that the UK being second in that list is kind of quite impressive, if I'm being honest with you. And as they say in this research, it's been quite consistent, you know, over the years. It's been doing this for a long time. It's got the 2015 sort of rankings here. Britain's up one place from 2015, before Brexit, before the pandemic. The world has changed a lot. And it's remained completely consistent, according to this report. So while we like to moan, I think, about retirement, and we like to moan about how the state pension looks, let's not forget the state pension's had a couple of good bumps up in recent years. The retirement levels from this survey, quite in depth, look pretty good.
Lee, I mean, that's the point, isn't it? If you move abroad, you won't have other Brits. No, actually, I was going to say you wouldn't have other Brits to moan about stuff with, but you wouldn't have the weather to moan about, you know. It's our national pastime. It's what brings us joy. Simon, if you had an idea, where would it be?
Oh, Dubai. No, only joking. Not Dubai, really.
Just don't see it for you, Simon.
I'm going to spend my winters in the Alps, and I'm going to spend my summers somewhere by the beach where I could surf, and I'll take Portugal actually at the moment, so it's my new favorite country. So yeah, I'll spend my winters in the French Alps and my summers in Portugal on the Atlantic coast.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Rob Morgan of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Rob, a question from a listener here. I'd like to invest for my son and daughter, aged 8 and 6. What's an easy way to do this?
Hi, Simon. Yes, there's one product that I would say particularly stands out for investing for children, which is the Junior ISA, which is a tax-efficient savings or investment account for a child under 18. Similar to an adult ISA, there's two types of Junior ISA, cash and stocks and shares. Cash ISAs are like savings accounts for the bank or building society, whereas the stocks and shares type are long-term investment accounts where you can buy funds and shares and so on. And where a child is young, taking on some investment risk for higher returns over the long term generally makes sense. But whichever you choose, and you can have one of each, any money you make either is interest on cash or investment income or profits is free from tax, which is important to your long-term returns. There's an annual limit for the amount that you can put in each tax year per child, which is presently £9,000. And as the parent, you control the Junior ISA account but the money is in the child's name. Now, the important thing to understand about junior ISAs is withdrawals are only possible from the child's 18th birthday, when it automatically converts to an adult ISA in their name. And at that point, a lump sum can be useful, of course, to help with higher education, deposit on a house, a first car, and so on. But that does mean that if you're looking to use the money before age 18, a standard savings account in their name, or just earmarking some of your own savings and investments, perhaps within an ISA, makes more sense.
Rob, thank you very much.
Thank you, Simon.
Welcome back. Reader question time. My girlfriend and I are currently in a one-bedroom flat that we bought in autumn 2022. It was our first property, and we locked into a five-year fix at 4.4%, which now looks high compared to what other people seem to be getting. We are desperate to move somewhere bigger. Both our salaries have increased substantially, but we're worried about paying early repayment charges on a mortgage, which is currently around £300,000. The story goes on. Simon, take it up.
Right. So this is an interesting one, because usually people want to take their mortgage with them to a new property, which is known as porting, because then they've got a mortgage that's cheap and they know that if they get a new one, then they will end up with a more expensive rate. And so that would cause them a problem. But the other reason for wanting to take it with you is that you don't want to pay the early repayment charges. And these can be pretty hefty. They tend to step down from somewhere around 5%, potentially to 1%. But you should watch out for this when you take out a mortgage. And you might think it won't apply to you because you won't move in that period, but you never know. And if you've got two broadly comparable deals, and often if you've got a mortgage, you might feel that the difference between 0.01% offer rate or 0.02% offer rate might make a big difference, but it's not. It's a couple of quid. And it might be worth you taking the one with the lower early repayment charges, because some mortgages have quite high early repayment charges right through to the end. So the answer to this is that you can take your mortgage with you. These people could actually find a better rate at the moment, but they could potentially take their mortgage with them in something that's known as porting. If their mortgage is portable, i.e. their lender allows it, so they need to check their mortgage documents, and also if their lender agrees to the new property. And lenders will sometimes not agree to lend on the new property. And in some instances, we have seen examples where they will come up with all kinds of reasons not to let you port a mortgage, usually because you've got a really, really low rate one and they'd really like to get you off it. The difficulty is that if you need to borrow more money to buy the property, which you're trading up, as in this case, then you're going to then need to take out an additional loan with your same lender, and you're going to need to get them to agree to that, and you can end up with two bits of a mortgage running over two different times. So for example, I know some people who've been in this situation and they just ended up with this kind of like one bit of a mortgage here, one bit of a mortgage there, and then the first one ends and then the second one hasn't, and then they're like, oh, what do we do? And originally they thought, well, we could just go on to the early standard variable rate because they weren't that high at the time. Interest rates had gone up loads since. The standard variable rate was going to be a fortune. So they had to fix the older part again, but then the newer part doesn't catch up with it, and so on. And you end up in this never-ending scenario. And actually, it's crazy because mortgage lenders lend over 2 years, 5 years, 3 years, 10 years, etc. There is no reason in this day and age why a mortgage lender couldn't lend to you over a bespoke period of time and just give you a rate for that. You know, if you're doing it with your own lender and you're trying to get your mortgages to run to the same length of time, there's no reason why they couldn't do that. It might require a bit of manual underwriting, but it's not exactly complicated, is it? When you think about what we can do in the world nowadays, if you've got someone whose fixed rate runs out in a year, in like, you know, 18 months, but they're moving home and they're going to lend with you, rather than forcing them to take a 2 year fix, you could just say to them, fine, we'll lend to you for 18 months. And actually, if you were rich enough, you'd be able to do this. But if you're just dealing with the bog standard mainstream mortgage market, you'll find yourself, you know, stuck. This is where it does pay off to speak to a broker, though, because the broker might be able to help you. They might even be able to sort this out with your own lender for you. It does become slightly tricky when you're dealing with your own lender through a broker and so on. But, you know, explore your options is what I'd say. The early repayment charge thing is annoying. I've tried this knowing that it probably wouldn't work. Our first mortgage was a fixed rate mortgage at 4.99% for 5 years. Now, when I took that out in 2006, that was a good deal. That was cheap money. We moved 4.5 years into it, which was really annoying. We'd agreed to sell our flat. It was 4.5 years in, and we still had like a 1% early repayment charge on the mortgage. So I contacted our lender at the time, which was NatWest, and I said to them, look, we're 4.5 years into this. Do us a favor, waive the early repayment charge. Come on. Like if we were a whole year or something, but you know, NatWest said no. I was like, come on, been a good borrower. I'm a nice boy, you know, open doors for people, say please and thank you. So they were like, no, it's in your terms and conditions, no. I was like, okay. Now, the difficulty was we weren't buying another flat. We actually ended up selling our flat, renting for a while, and then buying somewhere else. But we were definitely going to buy somewhere else. So I said to them, right, obviously I can't port it because we're not buying somewhere else, but could you just put the mortgage on hold for me until we get a new property? And then I'll put it on a new property, and then I'll pay you off the final 6 months, and I'll do the additional borrowing. If you're just like, no, that's not a thing. No, you can't do that. You can't have a mortgage without a property that it's attached to. So yeah, I had to give NatWest, like, it's really annoying. It was like £1,800.
Oof.
I know. Oof. Exactly. Oof. Do you know what I said? I said, fine. You know, appreciate it. I know you can't help. You could have just let me off this. I'm never taking out a mortgage with NatWest ever again. Anyway, guess who my mortgage is with?
NatWest?
I know, I forgot that.
Oops.
Totally forgot. I threatened to never take out a mortgage with them ever again.
Right. From buying homes to selling them or renting your homes. Lee, energy performance certificates. They rate how energy efficient a property is. So having a lower EPC rating of A, B or C can give households access to cheaper mortgages, may even increase house prices for prospective buyers who think they might have lower energy bills if they get that very energy efficient house. So look, it's really important, but how reliable are they? And if they're not reliable, well, what's the point? Lee?
I'm a little bit sceptical of EPCs, Georgie. Just a touch sceptical. So look, they are calculated by an energy assessor using government-approved software. What the assessor does is goes around, looks at the property's features, so insulation, heating, windows, lighting. They put this data into software and score the house or home or flat, whatever it is, out of 100. As you say, A, most energy efficient, G, least energy efficient, and having a house now can unlock, for example, slightly better mortgage rates, as people are encouraged to have, you know, better energy efficient, more energy efficient homes. Like, totally get that. Like, completely makes sense. And now to sell a home or to let out a home, you need an EPC. They're not massively expensive, but it's still an industry that, you know, makes money. And it's been around for a fair amount of time. And I remember a few years back, I actually did a kind of EPC calculator, a government calculator, to try and work out what our home was, and it spat out kind of the improvements that you could make and what that would likely do to your score and how much it would cost, and some of the costs associated to basically scoring it a couple of extra points for tens of thousands of pounds, and you go, nah. Now, we've got this survey from Atom Bank. Now, the best way for me to describe this survey, this data, is it was over 1,038 homes, and it compare CO2 emissions based on EPC ratings with measurements derived from actual meter readings from these same homes. You look at the bar chart in this story, and it is quite incredible reading, actually. So for an A, B, C, D, E, F, G property with the meter, all of them had them within a reading of 1 to 2 carbon emissions of how much is being kind of released. So a rating between 1 and 2. When you look at the EPC model, A and B is between 1 and 2. Then C just ticks over 2. D almost hits 4. E almost hits 6. And then F and G almost hit 7. That's a massive discrepancy between what is being told in an EPC And what is here? So Atom Bank assumed that this may be due to personal choices by households. So, you know, what they're doing, you know, maybe they were just being like, certainly, you know, being incredibly energy efficient. But experts at University College London's Energy Institute observed a similar pattern across a larger national data set, finding a little variation in primary energy usage above EPC band C, even after accounting for factors such as family size and thermostat temperature. And the UCL team is now working to identify causes of discrepancies as part of a government study into EPC accuracy, not yet published. That's going to be interesting reading, Georgie. I mean, you might be so interesting reading EPC. How can that be interesting? I find stuff like this incredibly interesting because it has become a large part of the property market. You know, it's become a large part of landlords expecting to have minimum EPC ratings of E. Very hard to achieve ratings like that in old Victorian properties, for example. The government is considering upping this requirement to a C from 2030, which would be for private rentals and holiday lets. That's not long away, and some of the changes that are needed for homes could be substantial and expensive.
Thousands.
And it kind of, it's good. I think it's good to have the question and having, you know, potentially experts looking at this, government-backed, to figure out if EPCs are worth, you know, the paper they're written on. Watch this space. We'll keep an eye out for that and see what happens.
All right then, Lee. Finally, you've been hobnobbing with the celebs again. This time for a piece for Me and My Money before we get into that. Simon, what's your ideal celeb to interview for Me and My Money? Or for just generally, but I mean, let's make it relevant, shall we?
Yeah.
What's Me and My Money, if anyone isn't aware?
Me and My Money is our celebrity money interview. Very long running. We've been doing this for many, many years. But Lee is in the process of really upping the stakes on the celebs that we're getting in.
No doubt, Lee. No doubt. Just your best mates in your phone, yeah?
We've obviously, you know, we tend to largely go for UK stars, but also, you know, international stars can be done as well. We had a conversation about this the other day in the office. I said I fancied getting Tony Hawk, the skateboarder.
Oh yeah,
he's a big Bitcoin fan as well, and has had a very, very long career with ups and downs over the years as well, and obviously made a huge amount of money out of the video games and things like that, and is, you know, still making a living from it in his 50s. So I thought that'd be an interesting one.
Going with the sporting theme, I would be probably quite interested in interviewing Robbie Fowler, one of the richest footballers. I mean, you've got to hand it to someone. When you have a list of people that you thank in your autobiography, when you thank your financial advisor at the end, that is, you know, he's done well.
And when the fans sing, "We all live in a Robbie Fowler house," he's exactly. The Guidelet Empire.
That's so true. So Lee, sorry, let's not steal your thunder, because you actually did speak to a big celebrity.
Steal my thunder all you like, Georgie. Does Robbie still do his property seminars? I remember they were kind of plugged quite a lot.
Go to one. Send it, Magnus to one.
Well, yeah, we could do. We could do. If you're asking me for my dream celebrities, I think it would be either Nicolas Cage or Ian Holloway. I think Ian Holloway would be interesting. There's a yin and yang there for you.
Stay with the sporting theme.
But actually, do you know, the whole idea, I was kind of toying last year with starting up a new podcast for us, and it was titled "Does Bex Have a Pension?" And basically the podcast would end as soon as I could get David Beckham on the podcast and ask him what his pension plans were. So it's kind of gone from that to, I said I'd been handed over the keys for the Me and My Money page, but as Simon said earlier, actually I've stolen the keys and I'm taking the page for a joyride. So you might hear a few little celebrity interviews. Does Bex Have a Pension segment on this show now, as I ask various celebrities about their ins and outs of their finances. So the Me and My Money page, it's a set load of questions, things like, do you have a pension? Do you have property? Biggest money mistake? Quite often celebrities will say a car. And, you know, what are your financial priorities? And what would you do if you were Chancellor, which is the clip that you're going to hear shortly from Mr. Ross Kemp, who is fronting up a campaign at the moment to pay your pensions some attention, which is the whole way I managed to get him to have an interview. absolutely sound guy. Really, really, really good to interview. He was really interesting and gave some really, really great answers. And you're about to hear some of that now.
So if I was Chancellor, I think I'd make it compulsory for kids to learn about money, to understand it. And I'm not, again, talking about the value, but also understand how to manage money, what money is. When I left drama school, I had a grant, a little bit of a grant, but mostly I relied on handouts from my parents, which were in baked beans more than in financial increments. So I had to work. I had to work in pubs, in cleaning toilets, working for a cleaning company. I had to work all the way through drama school, where there are other kids there who are far wealthier than me that lived off mummy and daddy, all got full grants because their parents didn't disclose, because they were self-employed, what they were really worth or what they were really earning. But my dad worked for the government, so there was no way of getting around that. And he didn't want to pay for me to be at drama school. So he didn't want me to be an actor. God bless him. Right? Maybe I never made that either, but I like to think I've done some good acting over the years. So to understand debt, to plan for their futures. And that, I think, would help immensely in terms of building a secure future for people. And I know it's not a dry subject. Kids are all on the internet right now looking at, you know, they want to be influencers, they want to be this. But how do you pay tax? What does tax go? Where does tax go? What does it mean? Why do I have to pay it?
It's so true, yeah.
I don't think that you can learn algorithms, right? Are they going to be really helpful when you go to your first job? Are you going to understand what PAY is, what self-employed is, what Schedule D is? You know, I think it's really important that it's done in a very practical way. This is not planning to get your A level so you can go to university and study economics at the LSE. This is just telling you basic, fundamental money understanding, because I think that's where a lot of people go wrong.
I totally agree with you. And actually, just really, really quickly, I got badgered last year to go to my daughter's primary school and speak to a group of year six children before they went off to secondary school. And I thought it was going to be really dry. I thought they wouldn't care whatsoever. The questions they asked me about money were some of the most profound things I've ever sort
really?
Of
been. But isn't that great?
I did it for 90 minutes. I felt like I'd done about 12,000 rounds with Mike Tyson. I couldn't talk. I was like,
But money isn't dry. Money is wet and it's liquid and it's interesting. And I've made documentaries about the laundering that goes on around the world. And it is fascinating.
Maybe it's time for you to do a program for children. I reckon that would be really good. You doing a money explainer for children.
Yeah, well, I'd have to go to school with them actually to understand it properly. I think you should do it. But the point being is, I do think that there is a real need for an understanding and breaking down how the system works, how some people make so much money, how others don't make virtually any money at all, but also just how the system works, and also questioning why the system possibly doesn't work that well.
So that was our Lee chatting to actor Ross Kemp. Just a little snippet there, Lee, a little teaser. Where can they get the full interview?
So the full interview will be in the Mail on Sunday, this Sunday, or you can read it on thisismoney.co.uk.
Lovely. Simon,
stat of the week. 2%. That's my stat of the week. Yep. First-time buyers are being offered a 2% deposit mortgage. So Newcastle Building Society, the seventh largest building society in Britain, is now offering borrowers the chance to go on the property ladder with a 98% mortgage. So that means you could buy with a deposit of as little as £5,000. But there's a catch and a caveat. Not if you've got your money from the bank of mum and dad. If you've got your money from the bank of mum and dad, you can't apply for this mortgage, which led my wife to ask the question of how are they going to police that? You do actually have to fill in a form when you get a mortgage to buy a house that says where you got the deposit from. But if your mum and dad gave you £3,000 a year ago or 6 months ago or 3 months ago into a bank account with another bank, and then you put it in your savings account and then you say it's coming from your savings, how are they going to police that? Who's ever going to know?
Yeah, unless they go to another forensic level of checking. But I'm just curious about the sort of, I'm always curious about these things. Why 2%? Why not 3? Why not 1? 99 sounds interesting. 97, less interesting.
Well, you know, I think maybe 3% is too close to 5%, which is a fairly standard kind of mortgage you can get. And perhaps 1% is just that bit too risky. So 2% is the number.
A nice round two. All right, fair enough. Start of the week. Thank you, Simon. That's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions, team, anything you'd like them to look into. Simon?
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. And David Beckham, if you do want to get in touch about your pension, I know Bex does listen to the podcast, stick my pension in the subject line. If presumably Bex's email is his own name. If you've got one of those really weird emails or you're sharing Victoria's or something, then stick it's David Beckham. I'll tell you about my pension in the subject line. That'd be great.
Love it.
So, yeah, email us at podcast.
Everybody welcome.
Okay. Yeah, everybody's welcome.
Not just David.
Everybody's welcome. Please don't everybody spam us with messages with I'm David Beckham and I'll tell you about my pension in the subject line. We will spot that. We will be able to police that perhaps in a better way than Newcastle Building Society can police their deposits, and we will filter those out. Or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate and read the comments.
Or feel free to message me on my multiple social media channels, which many people have been doing. Thank you very much. Read them all and pass them all over to the team. So thank you. Keep it coming. Not had David Beckham, though. I wait. Anyway, if you like our podcast, which of course you do, why not rate us wherever you found us? Because you're still listening to this part. It helps other people find us too.
Got to listen to this bit. Otherwise, you don't hear the mad stuff at the end.
This is the best bit where we go, Dimo Papi.
David Beckham listens to the end.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.